You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Do not think any man happy until he has died, free from suffering. That line, or something like it, depending on the translator, ends the grand tragedy Oedipus Tyrannus, Oedipus the King, by Sophocles. Literature is full of such meditations on death, and they give us memorable aphorisms. They come to us not only from the Greeks and the Egyptians, but also from the teachers of Israel. Among the troubling texts of Israel's wisdom tradition is Kohelet, whose title in English Bibles is often the transliterated Greek word, Ecclesiastes. And it's among those books whose questions includes this one. What makes a life worthwhile if succeeding generations undo the good that one has done? Scholars and preachers and readers have disputed for centuries where the intellectual center of the book resides, how the author relates to the persona, who seems to be Solomon, and a dozen other questions from and about and related in other ways to this puzzling book of the Bible. Today, Menachem Fish, a philosopher, and Deborah Band, an artist, will be helping me ask some new questions of Kohelet and asking about their and talking about their new book from Baylor University Press titled Kohelet, Searching for a Life Worth Living. Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome both to the show. Thank you, Deborah and Menachem, for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Deborah, before we get started in earnest, this book is a cooperative project between a philosopher and an artist, and as I just found out, also family together. And we should say something at the outset about the ways in which each of you shapes this volume. So you can let Menachem comment after you've talked to our listeners. But start us out with some story behind the volume. How did this work take shape in the early going?
So there was a story, and it goes back many years. About 30-odd years ago, my stepbrother was killed in a very sudden car accident the afternoon before Yom Kippur began, which is a very ominous moment in Jewish tradition. The Shiva, the seven-day mourning period, was cut short because another festival began 5 days later, but the family was still meeting for prayers at his and his wife's house with their toddler children. I came home from the Shiva, house, back to my parents' house. This is in Montreal, earlier than the rest of the family one night. Happened to pick up a copy of Kohelet from my parents' library. I have absolutely no reason why I looked at it at all. I'd honestly never really paid much attention to Kohelet ever before in my life. You know, sat through the standard congregational readings during the festival of Sukkot every year, but really it seemed very remote and I did not relate to it. Well, I picked up the book and I was glued. I spent the rest of the night pacing my parents' foyer with this book in my hands and saying, oh, he understands the fragility of life and death. I mean, when I arrived just in time for the funeral. I was living in Berkeley at the time and was completely overwhelmed by this maelstrom of shock and grief that I'd never seen before. And Kohelet seemed to have some sense of the tragedy, of the bizarreness, of the fragility of life. And I couldn't put the book down and thought of it many, many times over the years. But I knew there was something I was getting from him about the fragility, the transience of life, but there was also something I was not getting. And I made several attempts over the years to work on Kohelet, but each time I knew there was something I wasn't understanding. Flash forward about 20 years, my 20 plus years. I had just remarried. My first husband had died of cancer a few years before. I had just remarried, and my new husband, Michael, and I were making a trip to Israel to meet the friends and family on both sides. So we were at Menachem's house, Menachem and his wife Hannah's house, for Shabbat dinner. And Menachem just sort of innocently asked me, you know, he knew my work, but what are you working on? What are you planning to work on next? And I said, well, I really want to do Qohelet, but there's something I'm just not getting. I don't know how to go about this. And he said, innocently, oh, I've written on Qohelet. Let me send you the paper. So I downloaded it the following week, absolutely sucked it in, and said, oh, he gets it. He sees this problem. And had the chutzpah to drop him a note and say, okay, we're going to be doing Qohelet together. And I think he thought I was rather mad, but very gracefully said, well, I'm not quite sure how you go about visualizing so abstract a text. And I said, well, that's my job. And he very gracefully agreed. And so here we are. And it was a couple of years. We each were involved in other things. It was a couple of years before we really got started, but here we are now. And it's just been a wonderful ride. So that's the origin story.
Very good. Menachem, anything you'd add to the origin story?
Well, the origins of my interest with Qohelet weren't as sort of dark as were Deborah's. I, again, many, many years ago, was a young upstart of a rather dry analytical philosopher of science. And my father, who was a literary critic of some acclaim, and also a biblical scholar, was just retiring. He was rector of Bar Ilan University in Israel, and he was retiring. And the university held this international conference in his honor, and were very anxious for the son to speak on the father. And I was well acquainted with Dad's work, but couldn't find the door in. I mean, our interests kind of never really met. But then I read the last and ninth chapter of a book of his called Poetry with a Purpose, which is his book on the Bible as literature and anti-literature. And it was called Qohelet, the Hebrew Ironist. And that caught my eye, and it caught my eye because at one point towards the end of the chapter, he made reference to a philosopher of science, Karl Popper, whose work I knew. I said, well, you know, this gives me a way in. And it turned out to be a very, very happy moment for us, because to this day, as Deborah can well attest, I believe that paper of my father's, which I disagree with, I found myself disagreeing with, is the best piece on Qohelet I've read. So this was a master essay from a perspective I could not adopt. And so what I did at that conference was to sketch an alternative reading. And it turned out that everybody else who attended the conference, either ran with some of my father's balls or paid a tribute with some work of their own. But I was the only one who actually critically engaged his work in a very friendly manner. And Dad was sitting in the first row, and he was beaming, and he was the first on his feet, you know, with his finger in the air and so on and so forth. And it really opened for me a philosophical entry, into the biblical literature on the one hand, but also into the rabbinic literature, we won't get into that now, but there's a major reference to Qohelet, which I believe is the key to reading the book. And it opened a whole vista in Jewish studies for me, and a wonderful interface of conversation with my father, which became more and more meaningful over the years. So I, and then, you know, there's another story which I shan't get into of my distancing myself from Popper and developing my own philosophy of science, and this paved the way for a deepening of my original sketch of a reading of Kohelet, and I felt confident enough at that point. I always wanted to get back to the book, with my final reading of the moment at least. When Deborah and I decided to join forces, I did so because I felt that my own philosophy, general philosophy of knowledge, mind, and science had developed sufficiently to take on Kohelet with all its richness in a book form. So.
Very good. Well, Menachem, I want to spend a little bit of time on the introduction to this volume. And one of the interesting things about your translation and also about your commentary is that you render the Hebrew word hevel, and I'll rely on you two to teach me how to say those syllables properly, not as vanity, which is what I'm accustomed to from English Bibles, but rather as vapor. So as far as you can tell, why do English Bibles tend to go with vanity for that word? And what are your reasons for preferring vapor to translate hevel?
Okay. Let me start the answer a little way away from the actual question of the key word of Kohelet. I mean, throughout the lectures Deborah and I were giving since October 23, I've become more and more aware that the greatest mystery of Kohelet is its total lack of any kind of reference to the rest of the Bible. Now, there are many books written in the ancient world that don't refer to the Hebrew Bible, but this is a very, very religious book. God appears on every single page, and it's a monotheistic God, and he's breathing down your neck, and he's judging you, and you're accountable to him. This is not a pantheon of Greek gods. This is monotheism at a moment in which the Israelite religion was the only monotheism around. And that monotheism was articulated in 23 other books of the Hebrew Bible. And Kohelet, although deeply religious, anxiously religious text, even before you know what he's actually saying and claiming and arguing, and it's obviously an anxiously religious text. And there's not one word about revelation, about covenant, about God's word, about God's command, about God's promise, about retribution, nothing. So how can you square these two? This is something any viable reading of the text has to deal with. Okay, the religiosity of Kohelet on the one hand, yet its total lack of reference to its only frame of reference, basically, whenever it was written, and that is the rest of the Hebrew Bible. Now, there are two ways in the Hebrew Bible, philologically, to understand the word hevel. One is nothingness, emptiness, futility. This is captured by the vanity translation of the Latin. And the Hebrew Bible employs the term hevel with that meaning, but, and this is a big but with a capital B, but only with reference to idolatry and to idolaters. So when the Bible declares idolatry to be hevel, It immediately adds, that this is emptiness. It's these gods are absolutely futile, meaningless, and so on and so forth. Now, the subject matter of Qohelet is not idolatry. In the rest of the Bible, in the Psalms, for example, when referring to the shortness of the human lifespan, to our numbered days on earth, Hevel is used with a connotation of a mist, which is there and evaporates. Now, that's not emptiness and nothingness and futility and nonsense and absurdity, as Michael Fox would have it. Okay? That's a very different meaning. Now, the premise that human achievement under the sun, that what we can achieve under the sun is Hevel, can then be read in two ways. One is that human toil, human achievement, human endeavor is meaningless and empty. Okay? And then what the book will be saying is that, you know, that there's nothing we can do that has meaning, and therefore, you know, that verse at the end, therefore obey God's commandment, because that is the all of man. Okay. I'll get back to that in a second. An alternative reading, which I think resonates much, much better with the Bible's own use of the word, is because Qohelet is talking about humankind, talking about human life, talking about human work, an achievement. And therefore, to declare them temporary, time-bound, transient, makes much, much better sense than declaring, you know, the crown of creation, humankind, to be meaningless and futile and vanity. Okay? Now, the other kind of small twist of the screw is, if we cannot understand, I mean, if you go for the futility vanity option, okay, then we can never claim to have achieved anything, even in our understanding. So how can we obey God's command? We have to read that book. We have to understand it. We have to judge and evaluate and assess and confirm what the Bible is saying to us. But if human understanding is declared meaningless, empty, and vanity, then you cannot come back and say, obey God's word, because how can we know we've ever understood it? Okay? So that reading is very, very problematic. It also, between you, me, and the lamppost, it also makes for a very boring reading of, you know, banal reading of that book. But if what Qohelet is saying, that we are forever time-bound, we're forever historical in the deep sense of the world, we're forever the products of our culture, our time, our specific and particular language, how can we ever then know that we're doing what's right in the eyes of God, whose knowledge and norms and values are absolute and timeless? That's a very, very different question, and it's a deep philosophical, anxious worry. And, of course, it answers the question of why Qohelet makes no reference to the rest of the Bible, because he has to work out this problem for himself before the rest of the Bible can be opened.
And you'll see how that comes out expressly in the Illuminations. Yep. I'll talk about that a bit later.
Yeah, let's talk about some of these Illuminations, because, you know, I'm going to ask lots of questions about the Illuminations. And listeners, this is one of those episodes where I almost wish we were a video podcast. We're not, because much of the volume's wealth resides in the visual. So listeners, definitely get your hands on this book. Let your eyes take their time with it. With that in place, Deborah, talk to our listeners about the illumination of the first three verses of the book.
Nathan, you should urge the listeners to buy the book first so they can
get
the illuminations while we're talking about.
Yes, yes, yes. So listeners, pause the podcast, go get the book, or, you know, listen to the podcast, then go get the book, then listen to it again. You have flexibility. You have flexibility. But let's talk about the illuminations just on the first few verses here, because I think this will give our listeners a sense of what they're in for when they go get this book. As my eyes wander this page, I see a bird. I see the sprout of a young tree. I see a pouch of jewels poured out over the Hebrew text. Mm-hmm. A blue eye peering out from the book's an initial letter kof. Surrounding all of this, looping lines of Hebrew text in blue and purple make their way around the pages. There is a lot going on in this illumination. So I'm not going to ask you to explain every element, but take us through a few of the parts of these opening pages that you think will convince our listeners to go and buy this book and get their hands on it.
Sure. Before that, though, let me back up a little bit and lay out the sort of central theme of the imagery.
Please do.
Throughout the work, I've placed Qohelet in the Alhambra, you know, that magnificent, originally Muslim palace in Granada, in southern Spain, for a number of reasons. First, it relates to the use of the palace as a metaphor for human life. Midrash has a ubiquitous image in it, written, comparing heaven, God's residence, to a palace, and the human world to the gardens of the palace. So I took that metaphor and extended it to have the palace stand for, symbolize human life, the palace and its gardens symbolize human life. Magnificent, full of amazing possibilities, beautifully crafted, a magnificent, magnificent edifice, but ultimately it crumbles. It's not forever. And this is exactly Qohelet's idea about human life. We're given this gift, but it will not last forever. Now, the Alhambra is a magnificent example of this. It's gorgeous. You walk through its endless courtyards and halls and gardens, and you feel surrounded, at least I did, felt surrounded by the ghosts of these vivid personalities. As it happens, there was the current Alhambra is built on the foundations of a palace that was built by one of the two Jewish grand viziers of the Caliph of Granada. And the palace as it exists now was actually the home to a lot of the magnificent poetry and so on of the Jewish golden age in Spain, the convivencia, where Muslims, Christians, and Jews worked together. But if you walk through the Alhambra and its gardens, it's everything around you is glorious, and you're filled with all these images and almost sounds of palace life. But you look in the corners, and you can see the mosaics starting to break down. You can just see the garden walls starting to crumble, and you realize with shock and horror that, oh, even this gorgeous magnificence will not last forever. So it becomes an obvious metaphor for exactly what Qohelet is talking about. So the whole book is built around, not limited to, but shaped by imagery of the Alhambra. And that culture. Now, as to the illumination you're talking about, this is largely an introduction to Qohelet's entire entire thought as Menachem explains it. The I'm trying to get to the picture in the book. The first of all, the micrography that you see, that border of looping blue and purple text that you see. This is a specifically Jewish scribal art form called micrography, tiny writing. And I use it a great deal to allude to introduce a text that may not be the actual subject, that may not be the text that I'm actually working on illuminating, but it has some bearing on it. And there's a great deal of micrography in this book, and it's not all Hebrew. So what you see here is in this case I have all of Kohelet inscribed in micrography in the first three illuminations. What you see on that page are the second two illuminations, the introduction to the text in both Hebrew and English. So that's the middle and ending of the Book of Kohelet. The whole book is inscribed in the micrography in these first three pages. And without going into all the detail, which is all explained in the commentary in the book, this is about the significance of Kohelet in the Hebrew Bible and the transience of human life. The eye that you refer to is Menachem's eye, and in the middle of the introductory kuf, and the shower of gemstones pouring out of an amphora. This is a plain clay jar, such as you'll see in every archaeological museum involving ancient Israel. The jewels pouring out of it come from a midrash that expressly explains what Menachem spoke about how you must understand what Solomon, or rather what Kohelet, is telling us about the transience of life and the struggle to attain wisdom and serenity before you can understand anything else in the Hebrew Bible. So this is based on a midrash that appears in the collections of midrash on each of the books that are attributed to Solomon. So,
can I add a sentence to?
By all means.
About Debbie's illuminations. I'd like to say two things. First of all, the brilliance of using the Alhambra as a metaphor is not only its transience, you know, that it will go to dust in the end, and you can already see it happening. It's also time-bound in the sense that nobody will build a building like that now. It's aesthetic. It's glamour. Its great achievement is time-bound and historical and contextualized in its time and place. The same goes for every single human achievement. Glorious as it is, there's never a notion of timeless beauty. Or timeless or out of time, universal beauty. And this is also the key to our collaboration, because explaining all this in abstract, I'm using universal language. Now, very sharp-eyed and well-read philosophers will be able to contextualize my reading in my place and time, but there's nothing like an illumination with images. Deborah didn't say this yet, but what she does, she calls visual midrash. Now, visual midrash, you interpret a text by means of images, which are always concrete, always placed. Any text she reaches out to is a historical text. Every single image is from some time or some place. Many of the images are latter-day images. Many are sort of classical tropes, but they're always concrete and always time-bound.
There's even astrophysics, 21st century astrophysics, yeah, in here.
Yeah. So it sort of unwittingly lends a concretization of the philosophical idea of the reading by the very means of artistic illumination.
Mm-hmm. And Menachem, I want you to follow up on that, and I'm going to jump over to your commentary on the seventh chapter of Kohelet for this. But I'll be honest, you know, a lot of times when I hear about chokmah, you know, the Hebrew word that gets translated into English as wisdom, it's often a very confident, it's often a very practical-oriented kind of thing. But your take in chapter 7 struck me as Socratic or maybe even Kantian, because this is a notion of chokmah that mainly concerns itself with the limits of the human mind rather than with the glories of wisdom or with the power of wisdom or things like that. So my question is this, is this notion of wisdom basically the same as what one finds in Proverbs, or is this something that Kohelet develops independently or even in contradistinction to other uses of chokmah in the biblical books?
Yeah, well, I'm not a philologist. I mean, the word chokmah is used for human wisdom in parts of the Bible. It's used for Torah itself in parts of the Bible. Kohelet is the only sustained, at least I read it, as a wholly sustained philosophical argument from beginning to end. Starts with a question, offers two solutions which crash him into a brick wall. By the end of chapter 2, he's standing on the ledge with a gun to his head. He's despaired of life. It's the darkest few verses in the entire Hebrew Bible. And then something picks up at the beginning of 3, and from that point on, he's building up his solution, dealing with oppositions. I'll get back to 7 in a wee moment. And the book ends with, you know, bright is the light in the eye, and enjoy, rejoice in your youth while you still can, and so on and so forth. A very, very happy ending, and even a beautiful poem of death as the sort of natural end of human life, no longer full of despair, and so on and so forth. So the notion of wisdom Kohelet develops, the bumper sticker version will be, to be wise is to realize the limits of human wisdom, the inherent, necessary, inevitable limits. And the limits are that you can never, ever, ever know anything for sure. Why? Because your gaze, your understanding, your vocabulary, your judgment, what you take for granted, are all time-bound. At this moment, this looks like the absolute truth. But to be truly humanly wise is to realize that that absoluteness is an illusion. Precisely because of our time-boundness. And I mean, we could put it this way. Even if absolute truth fell in your lap, we have no way of recognizing it as such. Okay, so anything that seems to be right, we have to take with that sort of ironic distance, critical distance, realizing that this is our world, this is my perspective. As far as I'm concerned, this is the last word, right? But comes the next generation, they'll see things differently. Now, so then Kohelet the whole discussion is not how to overcome that limitation or to break the glass ceiling, but how to make the best decision possible within those constraints. And that's where chapter 7 comes in. In other words, the idea is to open yourself to criticism, to take to heart the unsuccessful attempts at projects like your own, to go to the house of mourning where a life is summarized rather than listen to the rebuke of the wise. And again, it's the rebuke not of people who know better than you, but who are wise like you, and therefore they will criticize you and you will criticize them. And it's this critical, you said Socratic, but it's not Socratic, it's anti-Socratic, because there's no wise guy who knows everything like Socrates. Socrates, excuse the diversion, but Socrates never learns anything. He's not really interested in what you think. He's interested in getting you to think the right way. This is a far more Talmudic type of dialogue, okay, where you engage in mutual criticism, okay, in order to enrich and deepen your position and perhaps learn something from other people and offer your criticism to theirs. And that's what wisdom is about. And even when you're absolutely sure of a maxim which, you know, you can't imagine it not being right, there'll always remain open the question, if this particular concrete situation falls under that rubric or not. And so you're always doubtful, you're always hesitant, and yet you have to take action. And the idea is to live and expose yourself to people who think differently. And in that way, you can sharpen and deepen what, you know, your take on things with the help of them and they with the help of you. And that in a nutshell is what being wise is. And I think that anyone who's been exposed to the Talmudic literature, it's that dialogism which lies at its heart, never boasting to know that this is the true word of God, but always offering another interpretation and another interpretation, being absolutely comfortable with diversity, with the diversity of human takes, which are given in confidence, but with that humility of knowing that although this seems absolutely right to you, there are people who think differently.
All right. Deborah, I want to ask about another illumination. And as with before, if there are other illuminations that you'd rather talk about, just talk about the ones you like on the way, the ones that I want to talk about. But the one accompanying Qohelet chapter 5, the passage about eating and drinking and enjoying the goods of one's labor. I saw two of the animals in this illumination, the lion and the leopard, and I immediately thought of, you know, Jeremiah 5, which, you know, that trio of animals I actually encountered in Dante years before I encountered it in Jeremiah. But then I read your commentary on your illumination, and your source, you say, is Pirkei Avot, the sayings of the fathers.
Right.
So, what's more, in the same illumination, the text comes to the eye in the shape of inverted triangles, pointing one direction on the English side, the other direction on the Hebrew side. So once again, there is so much going on here that I've just got to know, how do these animals and these triangles and all these wonderful things connect to each other? So tell us a little bit about this illumination.
Lovely. I happen to really love this pair. Okay, so it's, you know, Qohelet is concerned about irresponsible actions and wants you to think about how you use your time, how you use your efforts. And Pirkei Avot is a small ethical tract of the Mishnah. Of the Talmud, that is extremely well known. I mean, it's studied regularly, and, you know, Jews of all ilk use it, you know, love this text and know it well. And I've always loved it. And this line from there, they be bold as a leopard, as light as an eagle, as swift as a gazelle, and as brave as a lion to do the will of your Father in heaven, relates here to the notion that God is going to judge what you do. Do not be irresponsible. You know, live the right life. And so those animals are grouped around the texts which are done in these triangles. Now, why the triangles? The triangle is the Greek letter delta, which is part of scientific notation denoting a change of state. And of course, Kohelet's overall point is that everything is always going to change. Another image that I use for that that's all over the book is there's a Hubble Space Telescope image using many different frequencies of energy, frequencies of light, image of the extreme deep field of space. It was first done in 2006, I believe, and then again in 14. Now, my late first husband was an astrophysicist, so the first 30 years of my life, astrophysics were the dinner table conversation, and I knew this image from the moment that it came out. I use that image, and this image is showing the lights of the heavens going all the way back to the early universe. It's even in a snapshot taken at one moment. And so I use it continually to relate to the notion that, first of all, the creator is invisible, but part of everything in the universe, and the notion that we and everything about us, everything that we will do, you know, my dog's fur, the wind blowing around me, everything relates to it. It's all transient. Every particle making up everything in our world evolves, is constantly recycled through the stars. So, and you will see that all over the place. You know, Kohelet knows that God is up there. There's a firmament in between, and we are down here, and we cannot possibly know what is above. But he's telling us that everything will always change. So here, the transience is that we need to always judge what we do very carefully, because we know the one constant we know of is that God is there, and God will judge our actions. So live the best life you can. And everything is about change.
Well, that leads me to another question that I'd like to pose to Menachem, and, you know, the flux of life, and I'll try to avoid bringing Greeks into this, but, you know, the flux of life is certainly something that I had picked up on when I had read and studied Kohelet in the past. What you bring my attention to with your commentary is the relationship of the change and the transience, to use Deborah's word, of human existence with the unchanging nature of God. And I'll confess, that is a side of Kohelet that I don't usually pay attention to when I read this book, but you're getting me to pay attention to it. So here's what I ask of you: get our listeners to pay attention to that. Where is this unchanging God to be found in the verses of Kohelet?
Well, he says God is in heaven and you are on the earth. I mean, at one point. But the philosophical God is ever present. I mean, he's omnipresent in the book. Okay, and the big question is, given the fact, as I said before, that we can never know anything for certain, how can we ever know that we're doing God's will? And his answer is. And this, you know, he realizes this with a jolt, according to my reading, at the beginning of 3. where he says that not only is everything created in time, but because of that, God's demands from us are time bound too. In other words, that God, there is no way in the world that God in his infinite goodness could require of us to act in a way we could never work out for ourselves. Okay, we could never be sure of. And therefore, the divine demand from humankind is to do their human best, their time-bound best, will be judged by time-bound standards by God, not by absolute standards. That's one side of the equation. But what this means for the other side of the equation, of course, the revelation of the Hebrew Bible, right? Are you sitting down, Nathan? So this is the radical theology of Kohelet. And that is that God cannot control his message. He can dictate, he can speak to us, but it will always be refracted through human ears and human eyes and human understanding. And therefore, different people and different generations will understand the word of God differently. Right, and there's no getting around that. And you can't settle that by mere authority and hierarchy. Okay, there are people who are more learned, people who are less learned. But the fundamental diversity of human understanding applies to Torah itself. And therefore, only when he realizes this by the end of the book can he say that obey God's commands. And of course, what he has to mean by that, as you see fit, right? Observe God's commands according to your time-bound understanding, because that is the whole of man, okay? Which really means that each generation will have its own take on what we're commanded. And I think we belong to two religions that had a parting of ways precisely on that issue, right? Early Christianity decided that the word of God in terms of the commandments meant something very, very different from the way in which rabbinical Judaism read it. And then the rabbinical Judaism produces its human oral Torah, it's the way in which we understand divine revelation, and it's an entire plethora of contrasting voices, and the Talmudic literature is totally comfortable with that. Now this is a notion of religiosity, okay, which does not need dogma and is indifferent to a sort of simplistic notion of truth or timeless truth. Truth is relativized to language, to perception, to the human world of the human exegete. And that makes for a very, very interesting and philosophically fresh and very modern Kohelet. Now, of course, I'm reading him through my own flesh and blood eyes, but what I can say is that the text resonates, the text answers, the text unfolds to this kind of reading in a way that I don't know of any other reading, which are always sporadic, taking a verse here, a verse there, but I know of no reading of Kohelet that is an actual sustained, that reads it as a sustained philosophical argument from beginning to end.
That makes good sense. Deborah, I have to ask you about one illumination that, because I wrote my own doctoral dissertation on Milton and Shakespeare, it was a glorious surprise for me. I saw that, you know, one of your illuminations had an English text wrapping around the margin, and I said, this must be another English Bible. Ooh. And then I realized, wait, I recognize this, but this is not Bible. This is King Lear.
You got it.
So, you know, I've always thought about Shakespeare as a very biblical poet, but I've never connected King Lear to Coheleth. So how did you come across this connection?
I love this. Well, I love Shakespeare. Lear is such an extraordinarily powerful play. It, as time goes by, it seems to resonate all the louder nowadays. I'm fascinated by it in terms of the struggle of how to live with integrity, how a courtier can live with integrity while serving a corrupt ruler. And that's exactly the predicament that Coheleth is dealing with in the beginning of the eighth chapter. So, and that's exactly what Lear was talking about. So it occurred to me right away upon focusing on these verses, it occurred to me right away to include Cordelia's speech, wherein she is giving him an honest answer about her regard for him, rather than absolutely dishonest flattery that her sisters offered. So she says, you know, good my lord, you have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back as a right fit. Right? Why have my sisters husbands if they say they love you all? And so she's honest with him. And that's exactly, and knowing that she's taking a dreadful risk, and that risk is realized. And this is exactly the predicament that Coheleth is talking about here. And it's very real life. It's very real life.
Very good, so, very good.
And I love Shakespeare. And also, one of my concerns in developing my illuminations is to show the way the biblical texts reverberate throughout Western history, throughout Western culture. And this is a fine example. Shakespeare surely knew his Hebrew Bible. Surely knew it, and it turns up all over the place. And I absorbed every word of Will in the World and when it came out. And it's quite possible that Shakespeare may well have known this passage.
Oh, yeah. As I said, I mean, he is a thoroughly biblical poet. So I love... when someone teaches me to make new connections between Shakespeare and the Bible, and this book certainly has.
It's always a joy.
Oh, yeah. Menachem, I want to hear you say a few more things about the book's final chapter for me, really for me more than the listeners. You already started to talk about this, but I want a little bit of expansion on it. When I read Coheleth, I have always taken the end of the book as the addition of a later scribe, someone who is trying to take the edge off of the more radical segments of the book. But your commentary here has taught me to think of the book's closing verses not as a retraction, but as a conclusion. So I'm here to learn. I've always thought of this as, you know, roughly analogous to Geoffrey Chaucer at the end of the Canterbury Tales saying, well, don't take this too seriously. But you're saying, no, the ending of Coheleth says, no, take this very seriously, and to take it seriously, follow these commandments. So teach me about this book, Menachem.
Well, look, as I said, I'm not a philologist. This could very well be a later edition. But what I will insist is that if you read Coheleth as I suggest to read it, the person who added these verses understood the book very well. That would be my claim. I'm not saying that these are Coheleth's words, but I am saying that they're not. You see, the people who say these were added on as a kind of apologetic religious twist. I think that's to misread the book and to misread the ending, at least from my perspective. So I think it's a fitting ending to the book, whether it was added later or not. And what he's saying is, first of all, that what you get at verse 11, okay, the last four verses. So verse 11 says, "The words of the wise are like spurs and like nails well driven in, are the saying of the masters of collections. They are given by one shepherd." This is the first time in the entire book in which he's talking about the wise religious exegetes talking about the words that were given from the one shepherd. This is the first time in the entire book that divine revelation is alluded to. And you have to get to this point in order to realize, and the Talmud makes a whole song and dance in tractate Chagiga 3b, to be precise, on this verse. And it actually says these are the masters of the assemblies, are the people who study Torah in assemblies, in groups, in houses of learning. And when the student comes in, this one says this, and this one says that, this one says this is allowed, this one says this is not allowed. And the student says, "Well, how do I study Torah from now? You know, where is the truth?" And the answer is, make your ear like a hopper and make your own decisions. And so the Talmudic sages actually heard this voice as applying to Torah the reading I've outlined about the book. Tentative, time-bound, diverse understandings, even of the words of God. And therefore, my son, be admonished of making many books. And the idea of making a book is that you've arrived at the truth and now you're passing it on. You know, be careful with your truth claims. And this is the end of a book about not being able, you know, to boast anything to be the absolute truth except that we can never know the truth. And therefore, fear God, do your best to keep his commandments as you understand it, for that is the whole of man. But now you know what hearkening to God's word means. It means to the best of your knowledge, to the best of your understanding, fully realizing that your children will see things differently, and fully realizing, looking back historically, that former generations saw things differently, and that, you know, we are the masters of our own time and place, and at the same time constrained and limited by our own time and space. Okay, and so that's the way I read the end of the book, and I think it resonates. That reading resonates very well with what the book has been arguing for insistently until this point.
Very good. Well, Deborah, we're coming up to the end of our hour, and I want to ask you about one more illumination, because it's one that I think I've got a better idea of now that we've had this conversation. But I want to ask you anyway. The very last illumination, it looks to my eye that instead of looking out from the palace, now we're looking up at the palace on a plateau of some sort. And the frame of the picture, and I had to read the commentary to figure this out, is a cracked bowl. So do bowls just get cracked because that's how the world is, things change, or did something in particular crack this bowl?
That's lovely. Okay, so the cracked bowl, or rather, the bowl image goes through the book. It turns up four or five times. Now, this last illumination is the back bookmark, sort of bookend, rather, to the whole set of illuminations. The frontispiece of the book, shows a daylight scene. This painting shows a nighttime scene. The frontispiece shows the same scene in daylight, and the micrographic border, as I mentioned before, is the first third of the Book of Qohelet. Now, this one at the very back, the book is closing. He's finished his argument. The golden bowl is a reference that comes from verse 12.
Verse 6.
I'm sorry.
Verse 6.
Verse 6 of chapter 12. He says that he says before the silver cord is loosed or the golden bowl is shattered or the pitcher is broken at the fountain and so on. He gives a list of these metaphors for life and its end. And so here I've worked with the golden bowl throughout the book in different ways. And here, finally, it's cracked. This is a nighttime scene of the Alhambra on its hillside, on its ridge in Granada. This is actually based on a photograph I took of a glorious nighttime scene of the Alhambra on its hillside. At nighttime, it was very, very beautiful evening, and so there we have it. The argument is made, and life is finally ending. In the earlier part of the chapter, he has an exquisite paean to death, which he's no longer frightened of, given that he has found some kind of answer of what wisdom in the earthly sphere might be. There's a wide micrographic border around this painting, and instead of being the text of Qohelet, it's actually from, it's a series of 44 poems by a book called Ben Qohelet, Son of Qohelet, that was written by the first of the two Jewish grand viziers who lived and worked in the Alhambra. Let me read the passage that is actually borders the adjoining illumination for you. It's very beautiful and will give you a strong sense of this grand vizier and philosopher and poet's sense of Qohelet. Soul opens inside you on beauty and then tells you to seek in the world and ignore its flaws. Heart says, you'll live forever. And death, as it speaks, grasps you with claws. This is a wonderful series of short book of poetry. It's actually 80-some poems, and I worked with about 44 of them. And the man who wrote them was a Renaissance man long before the Renaissance. He started off as the Caliph's wine merchant, ended up as Grand Vizier and leading his armies in battle.
That's wonderful.
And a very deep soul.
That is wonderful. Listeners, I hope that you're getting a sense here of just how rich this volume is. I hope that you run out and get it. But right now, we are running up on the end of time. So, Menachem, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you two have the last word. You can start, and then when you're finished, you can pass the baton to Deborah. What do you two want our listeners thinking about Qohelet, about illuminating manuscripts, or about whatever else as we head for the door?
Well, let me say something about collaborating with the creative artist, because I don't understand it. I'll put this to our listeners as a question. What I found was that working on this project by talking over the fence of two very, very, very different disciplines, sort of philosophical a philosophical take on the book written in words in philosophical language, and a visual midrash of illumination. What I found was that my language as a philosopher gained clarity, and I don't know why. It gained clarity without dumbing down. It gained clarity without losing depth. And I mean, if any of the listeners will take another, a different text of mine and compare it to the, you know, to my reading of Qohelet, which I did in all philosophical seriousness, there's something about working across the boundaries by which I gained a clarification which I didn't think was possible. And I don't quite understand it. Maybe it has to do with the concrete nature of imagery of which I spoke before. But this has been a great adventure and a real roller coaster of you know, even of self-discovery from that point of view for me. And of course, in Qohelet, that stands to reason that, you know, you're reading into the text, not reading out. And in Qohelet, I discovered a phenomenal early Israelite biblical fellow philosopher.
Deborah?
I would say that to begin with, it was only Menachem who helped me really understand this book, which has been so important to me for so long. And it is all the more important, not only emotionally, but absolutely, but of course, intellectually. And working with him gave me the occasion to probe this, probe the text through history, probe the text through intellect. And it's been an extraordinary project. What I think I'd like people to take away from this is a gut level insight into the text, and that they and hope that they gain insight through the paintings, tying the abstract philosophy to the actual concrete world around us, and that the concreteness of the illuminations helps stimulate their own imagination as they probe what this text means to them in their own lives. That the text doesn't need to just be up in the heavens, but it's down here with us in our world.
Wonderful. Deborah Bann, Menachem Fish, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you. Thank you, Nathan. It's been
listeners,
a pleasure.
Thank you for downloading.
And a pleasure.
Yeah, listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Qohelet, Searching for a Life Worth Living from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I am Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.